Just how polarized are the political parties in Washington and Augusta? Senator Olympia Snowe shocked her constituents, party leaders, and political observers in February when she announced that she would not seek a fourth Senate term. She cited hyper-partisan politics inside the Beltway as one reason that she wouldn't run again.
And I do not see the polarization that now stands in the way of getting things done changing anytime soon. To the contrary, what I like to call the sensible center has now virtually disappeared in Washington.
Joining us by phone, former Maine Senator George Mitchell. Amy Freed joins us from our Bangor studio. She's a political science professor at the University of Maine. And in our Portland studio is Jeffrey Selinger, government professor at Bowdoin College in Brunswick. We invite you to take part in the conversation. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet @MaineCalling, post to our Facebook page, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Are politics more polarized than ever? This is Maine Calling. And welcome to my guests. Let's start with Senator George Mitchell. First of all, Senator, welcome to the program. Where are you calling us from today?
From New York.
New York, fine city where trust is just a name on a bank. Thank you for being here with us today. We're talking, as we just said in the open, about the reason that Senator Snowe cited in her decision to step down. And we should mention that in addition to serving as Senate Majority Leader for that stint, you're also one of the founders of the Bipartisan Policy Center, which lists reasoned negotiation and respectful dialogue prominently in its mission statement. Is Senator Snowe right? Has Washington lost its way?
Well, it's clearly very partisan. I don't share the view that it's more partisan than ever. Certainly, if you go back to the pre-Civil War period, when the issue of slavery deeply divided the country, it was intensely partisan then, perhaps more so than now in relative terms, although you didn't have the modern means of communication, which to a degree contribute to the difficulty that we have, nor, as a consequence, did we have the vast sums of money now being poured into primarily negative television. It is very tough now. There's no doubt about that, much more so than when I served as Senate Majority Leader. But some people look to the past with rose-colored glasses and imagine a time when there wasn't partisanship, wasn't any kind of personal criticism and attack, and I don't think that ever was the case in American politics.
You mentioned the 1860s. That was the time of the savage beating of Charles Sumner with a cane in the old Senate chamber. We don't have that now, but we do have the power of words and the power of media. Have those contributed?
There's no doubt about it. Politics is not something separate and apart from the rest of life and society, subject to the same influences, and the impact of electronic communication, particularly television, has dramatically changed the way people live in every society, including our own, and therefore it has had an effect on politics as well. Politicians adapt quickly, as most people do, and you learn pretty early when you're in office that reasoned, thoughtful statements don't get you on television. They aren't news. News is controversy. News is sensation. News is insulting comments. And so there is a downward spiral that encourages, not in a positive or affirmative way, but by mere virtue of what is the news. You add to that the powerful impact of negative television advertising, in which politicians regularly say to the public that the other guy's a bum and lousy and dishonest and so forth. And so it's easy to understand why people feel that way. It's what the political leaders themselves are telling them, paying hundreds of millions of dollars to convey that message. And you also have the tremendous power of repetition. A person makes one sensational statement and it's repeated, I don't know the number, hundreds, thousands of times on television, so it has a tremendous driving impact on people's emotions. So it's a combination of a lot of things, but It's very tough. I was just in Washington yesterday and this morning, met and talked with several senators, in fact, spoke at a function at the Senate, and everybody is lamenting the fact and really feel trapped in the system.
Amy Fried, we are also talking today about Augusta as well as Washington. Are we seeing some of the same problems at the State House in Augusta as well? Are they a reflection of what's happening in Washington or vice versa?
Well, I think we're probably never going to see the degree of negativity and incivility in Augusta and through Maine as there is in Washington, D.C., although frankly, it does seem like that has increased in the 15 years that I've lived in the state. And I think that's so because we're such a small state and people often know each other over a long period of time. In many cases, people live in the same towns. They may see someone who's on the other side at a Little League game or a soccer game at, some kind of community event. And that keeps them in touch with other people as human beings. And you really can't get as nasty with people if you see them as a fellow human being.
Jeffrey Selinger, feel free to challenge the very premise of this show. Are we overblowing this idea that Washington is trapped in partisan gridlock?
I don't think we're overblowing this at all. Let me just pick up where Senator Mitchell left off, is that it is precedent. That is, you think about the 1850s and the 1860s, the degree in, of animosity and division was quite prevalent and even violent, as you indicated earlier. So, on one level, our present condition is unusual because the norm throughout the looking at the large canvas of American political history, the norm is that the two parties are big tent parties, that they're have heterogeneous coalitions, and that they take in strange bedfellows. And the classic example of that is from the 1930s to the 1960s, the Democratic Party brought together conservative Southern segregationists with Northern liberals. And that was, in a way, what we took for granted to be the nature of the American two-party system, that our two parties captured as many as they can bring into their tent, and they kept them there. But what we've seen recently is something that's unusual but not unprecedented, which is a gradual sorting process where the Democrats have progressively become more uniformly liberal and the Republicans have become more uniformly conservative. What is unprecedented, however, is the emergence of a new political type, I would say, that has appeared on the political scene. And I have in mind folks like Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh and Lou Dobbs, who have an immediate and seemingly nonstop access to their audiences, and they have no responsibility to govern. So they are able to lather their audiences up in a frenzy and draw lines in the sand, which have important legislative consequences. And I think we've seen this most critically in the second term of the Bush administration on the question of immigration and amnesty. And very recently with healthcare and death panels.
I want to play another clip here in which the Senator Snow is talking about specifically the change in the Senate and where she refers to a shift toward sort of likening it to a parliamentary sort of a system as opposed to our traditional sense of what's happening in the Senate.
We are becoming more like a parliamentary system, where everyone simply votes with their party, and those in charge employ every possible tactic to block the other side. But that's not what America is all about, and it's not what the Senate is all about. In fact, the Senate purposefully requires a supermajority to pass significant legislation to encourage that we work in a bipartisan fashion.
Senator Mitchell, can you talk a little bit about how the Senate is set up in a way that really reflects what its role was intended to be as a kind of the reasonable side of the Congress?
Well, as Senator Snow pointed out accurately, it does require more than a majority not only to enact legislation, to bring legislation up. You can't bring up a bill if 41 senators object to your doing so. And, of course, you can't pass a bill unless if that number exists in opposition also. So the fundamental principle of democracy, which is majority rule, does not apply in the Senate. Now, you can argue, as some historians and analysts do, that that's a microcosm of the American system, that is the distribution of power in an effort to prevent bad things from happening, to make it difficult to do anything. But for most of its history, senators had some degree of self-restraint, a loyalty to the institution and to the country that exceeded their loyalty to party. I think self-restraint is now largely gone, and loyalty to party is increasingly a factor in decisions in direct disproportion to loyalty to the institution itself. So it is tough. Now, when I was Senate Majority Leader, I thought it was really hard, but it was nothing compared to now. I can tell you that when I was elected Senate Majority Leader, on the very day that I was elected, one of the first persons I went to see was Bob Dole, who was then the Republican leader. And I said to him, these are really hard jobs in good times and darn near impossible without any degree of cooperation. So I suggested to him a simple code of conduct that I said, I'll never surprise you. I'll never try to embarrass you. I'll never attack you personally. And I said, I hope you'll treat me the same way. Well, he was very pleased with my initiative. We shook hands. We never wrote anything down. It was simply a gentleman's agreement. And literally throughout those 6 years, in fact, to this day, Bob Dole and I have remained quite good friends, very close. We never once had a harsh word pass between us, publicly or privately, although we disagreed on a whole range of bills almost every day. So it doesn't have to be the intense personal partisanship that now exists. You can disagree civilly. People tend to conflate agreement or the absence of compromise with standing on principle. They're really two different things, and you can stand on principle and still be reasonable and flexible. Yeah. But it's tough. As I said, I thought it was very hard when I was there, but it's much, much more difficult now.
Senator Snow also predicted that over the course, if she had indeed run again, there would be another 6 years of more of the same, that this would be the profile of the Senate. Amy Fried, is that a reasonable prediction?
You know, it's really hard to know what will make a change because there really is a kind of incentive structure that is encouraging all of this. And some of that is what Senator Mitchell pointed to in terms of the what's going on with the news and the if you say certain sorts of things, you're going to show up in the news. You can also use that for fundraising. And also externally from the media, the kind of close media environment that people have in terms of people picking certain media, what social scientists call selective exposure, picking media that go with your point of view. And so, you know, as Professor Selinger pointed out, people will listen to talk radio and will get certain points of view. And there's a very close monitoring of what's going on. So between the radio, television, and whatever internet sources you use, Twitter, whatever selection that people have, people are monitoring the legislature very closely and then can very quickly respond either as individuals or through groups.
So Jeffrey Selinger, whereas in the good old days, an extreme senator who violated the rules of decorum might be penalized politically, but in the modern landscape, they're actually rewarded.
Yeah, I would say so. And who are they rewarded by? They're rewarded by this new media climate that we have where, or rather than rewarded, I mean, we could say they're rewarded, but they're also not punished by certain media actors who press them for certain commitments to draw lines in the sand when our political leaders are engaging in very public negotiations. And back in the time when Senator Mitchell was in office, Senator Dole and Senator Mitchell and the parties they represented could sit down and have a negotiation. They could find middle ground, even though they disagreed. The parties were differentiated, but they can have a meeting of the mind. But today what we're finding is that our political leaders, our elected leaders, can't cut deals, that they have been so constrained by whatever pledges they have given or offered to certain groups, or by a certain rhetoric of whether or not healthcare reform constitutes pulling the plug on grandma. Once you go that far, then the space for negotiation and for meeting the minds among those who know better, elected leaders, really shrinks.
We're talking about partisan politics. Yes, go ahead, sir.
Well, could I just add a comment on one subject that you haven't raised, and that's the influence of money in contributing to the effect that has been described. Money has always been a factor in politics, of course, not just in the United States, but probably in most human societies for a very long time. But it is profoundly distorting now, and the principal effect that it has is to sever the bond of trust between the electorate and their elected representatives. Most Americans now believe that members of Congress, elected officials, are more responsive to their contributors than to their constituents, to the extent that the two groups are not identical. That's a critical element in a democratic society, severing that bond of trust. And one of the reasons for that is the vast sums of money that have to be raised, and members of Congress now are on an incredible treadmill of devoting huge amounts of time and effort to raising money to fuel this this whole machine that it requires now in politics. And that's about to get much worse. I think that Senator Snow is correct in her estimation about what's going to happen. The Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court has unleashed in American politics not a new force, but an expansion of a prior force. It's now exists primarily in the presidential race, but there can be no doubt in anyone's mind that by the election of 2014, every candidate for the Senate and every candidate for the House will have a super PAC.
Yeah.
And you will see an exponential increase in the amount of money being spent and in the amount that is negative. The principal restraint on negative campaigning that has existed up until now was that the candidate who unleashed the negative campaign suffered because of association with it. Nobody wanted to be seen as negative, although if you could get someone else to do it and escape the responsibility, you benefited from it. Citizens United has enabled just that. And you've seen in the Republican nominating process the vast sums of money and the huge disproportion that went to negative attacks on other candidates. That's going to dramatically accelerate and, I think, unfortunately, further poison the atmosphere in the future.
All right. And with that, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions, email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or call 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back.
MPBN series of Your Vote 2012 primary debates continues with the two Republicans vying to challenge Representative Shelley Pingree in Maine's 1st Congressional District, Patrick Calder and John Courtney. Find out their stances on the economy, health care, social issues, and more. The 1st Congressional District Republican primary debate on television, radio, and online.
Join us tonight at 8 on MPBN Radio and MPBN Television, with repeats tomorrow night at 9 on MPBN Television and tomorrow afternoon at 1 here on MPBN Radio.
I went down to the river to watch the fish swim by.
That's Hank Williams from the soundtrack of the new Wes Anderson film Moonrise Kingdom. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Randall Poster, music supervisor of that film and all of Wes Anderson's films. He's also chosen music for directors Martin Scorsese, Todd Haynes, and Richard Linklater. Join us.
She's long.
You can hear Fresh Air tonight at 7.
The reality in America today is that the electorate is increasingly becoming divided into red states and blue states, which elect people representing just one color or the other. So the great challenge is to create a system that encourages and incentivizes our elected officials to look past their differences and find common ground if their initial party positions fail. Because in a politically diverse nation, it is only by finding common ground that we achieve results for the common good.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. We're talking about civility in politics. With me in the studio, Bowdoin College government professor Jeffrey Selinger. On the line from New York City, former Maine Senator George Mitchell. And joining us from our Bangor studio, University of Maine political science professor Amy Freed. We'd like you to join the conversation. What do you think we could do about the state of political discourse, either here in Maine or at the national level? The number is 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Senator Mitchell, you heard Senator Snow in the clip there. Is this about the emergent attention to red states and blue states, or was that more of a convenient, colorful media map?
No, I think it's definitely the case, particularly with respect to the House of Representatives, which is, as you know, subject to redistricting every 10 years following the census. Technology has enabled much more precise redistricting, and any restraints on partisanship in redistricting have been cast off. And as a consequence, increasingly the House is dominated by so-called safe seats. In fact, just recently in Washington, a couple of political analysts who follow the House very carefully estimated that about 70 to 75 seats in the House of Representatives would truly be competitive, and that the remainder of the 435 seats would be pretty much safe one way or the other. It's somewhat but less true of the Senate, because the Senate, of course, is not redistricted each year, and it's harder to accomplish what has happened. But what has occurred in the Senate is increasingly the number of former House members who run for and get to the Senate, and once there, rather than adapting themselves to the traditions and mores of the Senate, they carry with them into the Senate the standards and mores of the House, which is a much more partisan institution, thereby converting the Senate along the same lines.
Are both parties in this equally responsible? Amy Freed, I've seen some analysts point the finger at the Republican Party. Obviously, the Republicans point the finger at the White House and the Democrats. Is there a conventional wisdom developing about whether one party or the other shares more responsibility for this divide?
Well, what happened is, to some extent, there's evenness in that both parties are sorting themselves out and becoming more distinctive. However, right now, particularly since the election of Barack Obama, the Republican Party and the Senate particularly has really taken the stand to try to block absolutely everything. And, you know, if you look at the graphs showing the number of filibusters, they've just increased tremendously. And there are really some matters that are just really rather routine matters that there are still filibusters on, instead of it being something just occasionally done. So with the Democratic president right now, there really has been this attempt to try to, you know, block quite a lot, and not to, you know, to discourage any kind of compromise, it does seem to a number of observers that there's really more of this happening from Republicans. And in fact, even though I said a lot of this has happened since the election of Obama, you could also go back to the 1994 election when Newt Gingrich was trying to gained power and did gain power, was able to take the House of Representatives back for the Republicans for the first time in 40 years, and did that in large part by trying to cultivate distrust in government as a whole, and used very, very negative kinds of language that had been developed by Frank Luntz, public opinion researcher, at calling Democrats corrupt and all kinds of evil, negative kinds of terminology. So, you know, it's I mean, certainly some of this can happen from both sides, but there's also a history of trying to undermine trust in government altogether. And the Democratic Party is the party that tends to want to use government for particular ends, while the Republican Party is just more skeptical of government altogether. And so it's a political matter, but it's also consistent with their policy positions.
Jeffrey Selinger, there's a perception, I think, here in Maine that there are a growing number of independent-minded voters, indeed unenrolled voters. We're talking about this Democrat-Republican thing as if it's in a context of the country's split 50-50. But in fact, there are a lot of voters who just don't identify with either party. How does that play into all of this?
Well, the independents are extremely important insofar as what some social scientific research has shown is that independents tend, all else being equal, to have less information about politics. And once they learn, or to the extent that they become more informed about politics, they choose sides. And one pattern that we've seen getting picked up by politicians and is a kind of convenient crutch that many American citizens rely upon is this way of projecting a kind of consensus among the American people, that there's a silent minority of quote-unquote regular people. And what interferes with the process are selfish politicians and special interests and certain elites that make the public debate and legislative process a slow or unattractive, not civil, impolite. And that's largely not the case, that this is a very big nation. There are a lot of different views, and these are important issues. People are going to disagree, and they might disagree quite deeply about some of these issues that we're talking about.
1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. Let's go to the phones and to Auburn and Silver. Hi, Silver. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Yes, go ahead, please.
I'm a past president of the board of the Maine Council of Churches, and we responded a number of years ago to the sense of incivility and hostility, vilification in public debate by drawing up a covenant for civil discourse. This year we have sent it to everybody who has sent in their papers for statewide office and have gotten already some over 60 responses. The main factor of our covenant and the way it differs from the state ethics law is that we have a statement that says, I covenant to expect that any person, party, campaign, or corporation working on my behalf or to whom I contribute my time or money in support shall follow these same covenantal statements, which we hope will help us get back to that very sense of neighborliness which one of the panel members originally cited as a reason why Maine's politics was more civil.
Senator Mitchell, from where you stand, is there as a noted peacemaker, as we mentioned at the top of the show, in Northern Ireland and other divided places in the world, is there a prescription? Would there be a Mitchell plan for restoring, for example, the Senate to where it should be?
No, there isn't a Mitchell plan. One of the reasons I succeeded in Northern Ireland was there wasn't a Mitchell plan there. I recognize that any agreement would have to be the agreement of the parties themselves. I encourage them in that direction, but essentially they had to have ownership of it. And I think the same thing is true of politics in our country. I think it's the public that needs the ownership of it. The fact of the matter is, as was just commented, this is a very big, diverse country. There are a lot of different and competing interests, and it's changing all the time. It's not static. It's a dynamic, growing and changing society. and therefore there has to be constant change and response by the public. Right now, the problem is, frankly, that the public says they don't like negative advertising, but all the evidence is that they do respond to it. The public says they're concerned about excessive spending, but they don't respond in terms of voting for or against people on that basis. In the end, I think change has to come when the public responds in a way that sends a very clear message to political leaders that they want change in the direction that we've suggested and in which the gentleman from the Maine Council of Churches just suggested. That is, I'm not familiar with the covenant, the specifics of the covenant that was described, but I assume it encourages constructive discussion, responsible behavior, and a reduction in the kind of personal attacks and other criticisms and partisanship that now occur.
All right, we're going to take another short break. When we return, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
Intelligence Squared U.S. invites the world's leading thinkers to debate today's most critical issues.
What on earth is so special about football?
Football is America. It is the melting pot.
The amount of money the coaches make is insulting.
The next topic up for debate, ban college football.
Join us for Intelligence Squared following Maine Calling at 1 o'clock.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, we look at the soaring rate of teenage diabetes in this country and ask, what in the world are we doing to our kids? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point tonight at midnight.
And welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Civility in Politics. With me in the studio, Jeffrey Selinger, professor of government at Bowdoin College. On the line with us from New York City, former Senator George Mitchell. And in our Bangor studio, University of Maine political science professor Amy Freed. Join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net. Post to our Facebook page or tweet at Maine Calling. We got an email earlier from a listener who was pointing to a group, No Labels, which is one of the groups aimed at, dedicated, as it says, to improving the functioning of Congress, but also suggesting specific steps such as no budget, no pay, that there are real direct penalties for failing to do the people's business. Senator Mitchell, will that kind of an incentive work?
I don't think so, because trying to develop criteria by which to measure performance will inevitably reflect the political point of view of the person establishing the criteria. For some people, not passing any bills at all in Washington is a good thing. And they may well be very sincere in their beliefs. So for them, the standard would be if you don't pass any bills, you're doing well. Another standard held by many others is that you've got to pass certain bills that agree with our preordained belief. I would have to see the criteria, the method by which the group suggests that there be a measurement, pay for performance, before I would make any final judgment, but I think it's going to be very difficult because the public is divided. Let's face it, this country is about equally divided. Look at the last few elections. The public trended toward the Democrats, not by a large margin, in 2008 and 2006, trended toward the Republicans in 2010 and 2004, and in the election of 2000, Al Gore got more votes than George Bush, but Bush won more electoral votes and therefore was chosen president. You can't get much more equally divided than that. So I think that trying to establish the metrics would be very difficult.
Yeah, Amy Freed, is this just the shape of things to come?
Well, I think it probably is going to be really, really hard to change it unless there is some break in that kind of evenly divided logjam. And I just have to tell my one of my favorite little jokes, which is, believe it or not, you'll question at first whether it's relevant, but it's one of those light bulb jokes, and it's how many psychologists does it take to change a light bulb? And the answer is only one, but the light bulb really has to want to change. And so, you know, do people really want to change? Well, some, you know, in some cases, there's benefits to this. As Senator Mitchell pointed out, people don't want something to pass. It's that's a positive. You're anti-government. You don't want government to do things. Well, it's then good when government doesn't do something. And if it helps you get elected, you know, even better. So, you know, it's hard to know unless there really is some kind of break in the public as a whole moves more towards one side than the other, and I don't know. It's a very difficult situation.
Well, allow me to play the role of contrarian just for a moment. I promise to be civil. There is something to be said for what's now being called tactical radicalism, that is appearing in public to be uncompromising, and this is a practice or that has. Or many observers have, with some justification, have seen an asymmetry in the extent to which this is practiced on the left and the right, that Tea Party advocates and activists in the streets, they seem quite uncompromising. And I think the perception that they will tolerate no compromise or brook no compromise has an important impact on their representatives. And the Democrats are not seeing the same kind of signal coming from their base, so to speak. So, in a way, the whether or not they're being sincere, the kind of appearance of radicalism has pushed the needle of the center to the right, and it's been quite a successful strategy.
Let's go to West Bath and Terry. Hi, Terry. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Yes, I'm in West Paris, actually.
Oh, so sorry about that.
That's okay. In addition to the lack of civility in the gridlock we see at both the national and state levels, and this is going to date me, what I miss is intelligent oratory and debate. I remember Everett Dirksen, Hubert Humphrey, and the object of oratory and debate is to compromise. And when you watch C-SPAN, they're just standing, stating their positions, and sitting down, and there's no give and take, and frankly, the oratory that's offered nowadays is, frankly, position papers and talking points.
Senator Mitchell?
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Senator Mitchell, did you want to weigh in?
I think that's generally the case. Oftentimes, of course, in the Congress, the real action and compromise takes place in committees as opposed to debate on the floor. But I think they both that the circumstance described applies to both, and there has clearly been a marked decline in the willingness to express compromise. Others have commented on reasons for that and the degree of success that has achieved for some, and it does pose a very serious question whether the public actually likes that. Just in Indiana recently, of course, there was a primary election in which Senator Lugar, who'd been in the Senate for many years, was defeated, and the candidate who defeated him campaigned very vigorously on the position of no compromise. That is to say, he publicly said he does not favor compromise, that in his view, the other side must come to accept his point of view, and he won. So that sends a pretty clear message from at least that portion of the public that it does find favor. And ultimately, in a democratic society, significant change can't happen without some fairly broad-based degree of public support. And right now, it appears that, again, the public is divided on it.
So in some ways, Amy Fried, it's as if the public is being told that compromise equals weakness.
Right. And there's a whole debate in political science, the extent to which this is driven more by legislators, elected officials, the leadership side versus the public. You know, what sort of what comes first is one of the things that people, you know, they're trying to understand. But, you know, I'd go back to a point that Senator Mitchell made about the House with the, you know, when you draw a district and people are so good at drawing these lines during the redistricting phase, you end up with a situation where it's really the, you know, the primary electorate that the legislators most concerned with are the people who vote in the party primary and not the general election electorate. And it's sometimes characterized as a situation where the voters are not picking the officials as much as the officials are picking the voters. So you end up with sort of the most hardcore group from your party, and then those are the people who are least likely to want to compromise. Now, we're seeing some of that happening with the Senate as well. But then you end up sometimes with people who really can't win in that state. While with the House districts, because they are so tightly drawn, then a lot of those folks do get elected.
We only have a few seconds left. I want to work in one more call to South Portland and Bob. Hi, Bob. What's your question real quickly,
hey,
please?
Hey, thank you. You know, when the founding fathers or the early leaders were choosing where to put our nation's capital, they specifically chose Washington, D.C., because at the time it wasn't close to anything. It was actually a swampy area. And the people like Jefferson saw that if the public officials that were elected as servants with trust from the public that had voted them in, if they were too close to people with money and the wealthy and the big companies, and there are already wealthy people and companies in the country forming, that the government would be captured. And these are this is a term that they used at the time. They didn't want a government to be captured by the wealthy interests. And this is exactly what's happened. It's happened on the national level. The Republicans have been far, far more guilty of that, but the Democrats are certainly right in there taking money and being corrupted. On the state level, we have Governor LePage, who cut and pasted a corporate agenda as the policy of the state of Maine.
We're going to run out of time here. I was hoping for a short question there. Obviously, he's pointing to the influence of money in politics. Any final words, Scott Selinger?
Actually, about that question.
Jeffrey Selinger, sorry.
No, that's fine. The reason why Washington, D.C. was chosen was it was part of a political deal. It was part of a compromise for Jefferson and the Republicans to go along with Hamilton and his new bank and financial agenda. So this was it was an instance of compromise. They didn't put it there for because that was their original design or that all the founders agreed. That in and of itself was a process of coming to some mutual understanding.
And with that, I'm afraid we are out of time. Senator George Mitchell, Amy Jeffrey, thank you all for being with us today. And thanks for joining us. Senator George Mitchell represented Maine in the U.S. Senate from 1980 to 1995. He was Senate Majority Leader from 1989 to 1995. Amy Freed, Professor of Political Science at the University of Maine, and Jeffrey Selinger teaches Government Studies at Bowdoin College. Today's program was produced by Jonathan Smith. Our volunteer Scott McAuliffe answered your calls. Lindsay Maynard ran the board. And we received help today from David Bartlett and our Bangor studio and from the MPBN web team. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.